Bill Arkin has been a columnist at the Washington Post from 1988 to 2008, when he began working on the controversial series that have been incorporated in Top Secret America. Bill Arkin had been a columnist at the Washington, before that, in the 1980s, he co-authored the first volume of the Nuclear Weapons Data Book for the National Resources Defense Council, and subsequently worked for the Center for Defense Information, the Institute for Policy Studies, Human Rights Watch, and Greenpeace. He also contributed at the time to the German Green Party's efforts to rid Europe of its stores of nuclear arsenals. Bill Arkin later worked as NBC News military analyst in 2007 to 2008. He was a policy fellow at the Kennedy School of Government in the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University. In 2005, he wrote Code Names, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. And now let's welcome Bill Arkin to the special edition of Takes on the World. Welcome, Bill Arkin.
Thank you so much for having me on, and I'm happy to support your station and urge your listeners to do the same.
Well, thank you very much for your support on that. If you could speak up just a little bit. You and Dana Priest have produced an alarming and not a little frightening book which shows how in the post-9/11 world the battlefield has come to include the United States. In the introduction, you describe the country being in a, quote, a perpetual state of yellow since 9/11, referring to the color code devised by the Department of Homeland Security, which indicates that there is, quote, a significant risk of terror attack, end quote, and how willingly the public accepts the inconveniences caused by this a decade later, without questioning what it has got for the hundreds of billions of tax dollars that have been expended establishing what your book describes as the new American security state. Nor, aside from your book, has anyone paid much attention to the way this new security state has enriched the bank accounts of a number of former government officials whose jobs have been ostensibly to defend our country. Congress also should have been paying attention, but it seems, from what you write, it's part of the problem as well. How did this all come about?
Well, I say, first of all, that, I'm in a very pessimistic mood about America. But I'm also not particularly pessimistic about the American people. And, when we started working on this investigative series in 2008, it was clear to us that something had really tangibly changed in Washington and had changed in government. But it was not the kind of thing you read in the U.S. government manual or even can peruse in the laws of the land. It was something that was going on underneath the surface, and really, when you start to delve into secret government, of course, you end up at a lot of roadblocks. And we tried to come up with a way of investigating this that was tangible to people's lives. And the idea was, well, everything that happens has to happen somewhere. There are secret prisons, and they have to be located somewhere, and there's government surveillance going on, and somebody has to be reading those emails and looking at those pictures, and somebody has to be doing the warrantless wiretapping, and it has to be done somewhere. And we started to collect together locations and government entities and companies that all seem to have newly been involved or created or enlisted since 9/11. We were excited when we got to 100. We were ecstatic when we got to a couple of hundred. When we got to 300, we went and started to talk to some of our sources in the government who doubted our results and poo-pooed what we were doing. But when we got to over 1,000 new government organizations and over 2,000 corporations that had been created since 9/11 and showed lists and maps to people in government, including the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, and the CIA director at the time, Leon Panetta, they essentially accepted what we had and admitted that they really had no idea the overview of the extent of contracting and secret work that was going on in the name of counterterrorism and homeland security since 9/11. One would have thought that since that time that would have provoked congressional investigation and you know, a broad relook, particularly in a new administration. But really, none of that has happened. And though the budget reductions are having some minor impact on the military, the impact on the intelligence community is minor, and this certainly our gigantic homeland security apparatus, which is now proliferating down to the state level in places like California and elsewhere, is seems to be here to stay, and the only people who seem to get it are those who are either in the Occupy movement or in the Tea Party movement, who ironically both intuitively understand that the federal government is out of control.
When you write that in Washington alone, there are 33 building complexes devoted to top-secret work, taking up 17 million square feet that have been built or under construction, which is equivalent in size to 22 Capitol buildings. Are the costs of these operations public? Does anyone know how much this is costing? And what is the so-called Progressive Caucus in Congress doing about it, if anything?
Well, you know, in some way, most of this is very obvious. In some way, you know, it's very clear what it is that we pay for defense and intelligence and national security. The fact that it's split up into many different departments and that it's complex and difficult to understand because of bureaucratic interests is really secondary. What's interesting is that Washington has become such an epicenter, not only because it is where the government is, but it is because it's sort of almost become a separate culture from the rest of America. And that was the point of our focusing on the building boom in Washington, and also the fact that about half of the organizations and corporations which had been created were in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. So I don't need to then tell you that 10 of the 15 wealthiest counties in America are in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. And I don't need to tell you that most of the counties in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area have the lowest unemployment rates of anybody in the nation. And so you have sort of two countries now, the country of national security in Washington and the rest of the country, and one of those is prospering quite well. And I'm afraid to say that Congress, in a certain way, has become a part of the problem. Dropping the ball both on oversight and also always mindful of the fact that the second career for any congressman or senator once they leave elected office is going into the lucrative consulting and special interest lobbying world of national security.
Well, we refer, we have a special section in the book, how the global war on terror, what they call GWAT, has been a profitable vehicle for former government officials and retired generals and admirals who go into the private security and intelligence business. And you cite examples of the first two directors of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge and Michael Chertoff, and the former head of the Air Force, Michael Hayden. Perhaps you could elaborate on those cases.
Well, I mean, these are just typical people. You know, we could have named hundreds of others, but certainly, in our society today, when somebody goes into the military and even becomes a four-star general, they're finished with their 35-year careers in their mid-50s. And so, you know, a lot of them have kids in college and have bills to pay, and they haven't been necessarily in lucrative careers. But what we have seen consistently since the late 1980s, and certainly accelerating since 2011, is how much money they can make on the outside, how much money they can make in corporate boards, how much money they can make in their own companies, how much money they can make in lobbying and in consulting, and that is the consistent and almost universal path. There are 1,600 retired generals and admirals in the United States, And just by coincidence, two-thirds of them live in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. Now, do you think they were born there and went home there? I don't think so. They're there to work, and they're there to be part of a system which is far more powerful than the transitory elected system of government that we assume we are under.
Now, it's interesting when you and Dana Priest put this book out, first the series out, you were widely attacked, and not on the information that you had given, not the message, but the messenger, and your past affiliations with groups like Greenpeace and Super Policy Studies and Human Rights Watch and so on was used to identify you as being biased in producing information, but they didn't seem to question or were able to undermine what you had actually put out.
Well, you know, I've been dealing with this for a long time, and trust me, the Washington Post is, you know, is a mainstream organization that vetted our material, fact-checked it, and there was a team of 20 people working on the databases that we compiled. So really, I would have to say to you, in honesty, I expected more of an outcry when the series came out, because here we were identifying the locations of all of these top-secret companies and entities of the government working on counterterrorism. I would have thought that more people in the mainstream would have protested. But really what I detected was that there was this odd confluence of people on the right and people on the left unifying in their view that federal government was out of control and that even national security, which is something that was usually sacrosanct, could be criticized and indeed deserved to be criticized. So though I've lived with some pretty serious repercussions of things that I've done and written in the past, as has Dana, who revealed the secret CIA prisons and won a Pulitzer for that, and revealed the mess at Walter Reed Army Hospital and won a Pulitzer for that. You know, both of us walked away from the Top Secret America Project and said to ourselves that we were very surprised at how much it struck a chord in the American psyche that people accepted what we were saying. And really, the only disappointment was that it didn't equally captivate Washington or the Congress to take some kind of action.
Well, you write about a law. Speaking of our Congress, a law introduced by Democratic Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland that now covers everything a government agency stamps as classified. And if that had been passed immediately after 9/11, it would have made, for example, the reports of the tortures of prisoners, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and the reporting of the government's extraordinary rendition program a criminal offense. It's extraordinary. What's extraordinary is how this has increased, as you write, this clamp down on information has increased. Not even stayed the same under the Obama administration, and yet there has not been really a widespread public protest against this. How do we account for that?
Well, you know, to some degree, again, it, presidents come and go, and the national security establishment, is a very powerful and permanent. President Obama has really had a difficult time or failed in keeping most of his promises relating to national security, and in fact has sort of adopted much of the Bush administration's policies and plans relating to that. You know, the question for our society is how can you assess the adequacy, the cost, the size of all of these programs unless you have a clear sense of what the actual threat is. And you know, right now, between Iran and Al-Qaeda and the administration's so-called pivot to China or pivot to Asia, with situations in Syria threatening potential military intervention, I think the American public is, buffeted and thrown around every day with the sense that the United States is either responsible for dealing with all of these threats, or that all of these threats, in fact, are real and are intended in some way to destroy us. Unless we get to the point of being able to question the nature of the threat, particularly the nature of the terrorism threat to the United States, and understand how much it's oversold and how much it's used as an excuse for this perpetual state of war, we're really not going to be able to do very much about the way things are spent in Washington or the size of this establishment. And Obama is case one of the fact that so little can be done to make reform. And I just don't see much happening until the American people kind of say enough is enough. And I kind of hoped for a reevaluation of where we were on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, but it seemed to have come and gone without really anybody sitting back and taking stock of where we were.
Well, my guest is William Arkin, who has co-authored a book with Dana Priest, Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American National Security State, which is we're offering at a premium. I see some people have already taken that premium at $150 for this amazing, extraordinary book. It's the kind of information that most people aren't really aware of. I think, you tell the people the truth, they'll act on it. But we, in our public schools and our public life, there is no discussion. Even Occupy movement, which is very important, focuses on the 1% that controls the economy of America and the direction of America. But I would think you would have to be broadened to even include the national security state, not just the fact that 1% have all this wealth and power. What do they do with it? What would you think on that?
Well, I think there is a relationship, though, and because it is all about power in the end. And, the reason why our economy is distorted and the reason why so much is not available to us for our oversight and scrutiny is exactly because of the culture of national security that we live in. So I wouldn't say that the two are separate. I would say that the Occupy movement and the Tea Party movement, for that matter, don't necessarily know how to approach the question of national security. Look, it's tough. It's a tough issue. It's all tied up with secrecy, and people are afraid to question the efforts of those who are in the profession of securing our nation. But I think that this is definitely one of the keys to unlocking the door is going to have to be some kind of revision of our national security policy. I don't think our economy or our social order is going to make much change until we are able to get a control over the size of the government's involvement in national security.
Do you see any signs of progress in this? I mean, we do have the Occupy movement, which is a sign of awareness of people across the country that something is wrong with the Tea Party, which unfortunately has the elements, of course, is being funded by the Koch brothers and is being directed in a certain way to kind of confuse, but it did represent a segment of the American people just being upset with the bailout of Wall Street, something that probably could not have happened had we had a McCain presidency. But this election debate, so far at least, doesn't seem to deal with this issue at all. I mean, with the prospect of potential war with Iran, the USS Enterprise, the old battleship going into the Persian Gulf, the expansion of U.S. troops in Asia and declaring that Asia is confronting China with our military is the answer, where to China's sending construction workers and huge loans and expenditures around the world. We're in for more of this, it seems. More of the same.
Well, I guess I would say we are. Maybe I'm more optimistic than you are about what the people intuitively understand on both sides of the political spectrum. And, you know, having worked across the world of both the nonprofit and what I guess would be called the leftist world in places like Greenpeace, and then working in the mainstream in Washington, even as a consultant to the Air Force, you know, I think I have a pretty good sense of the way these different institutions and people think. But I come to the conclusion that people's intuitive view of government in a really classic sense is correct, and then the question becomes: at what point are we going to take action? And I don't see that really bubbling up in the country. I don't really see that happening in the presidential campaign. I don't really see that happening in President Obama's leadership. And so, the question of what the next step is between recognizing that 9/11 was the result of government failure and that what we've done as a result of 9/11 has only made things more difficult and worse in our society, it's really going to be quite a difficult job of repairing the nation.
Well, we're certainly in a difficult situation. Should there be a war with Iran, and which may be a 50-50 proposition. I don't know how you look at it. It depends from one day to the next. The top chief of staff of the Israeli military was reported today as saying he doesn't believe Iran is going to have a military weapon because the government of Iran is rational. That will upset a lot of the warmongers in Washington as well as in Israel. But from day to day, it seems that we're on the threshold of another crisis when we still have an economy that hasn't come out of the last one. What is it going to take? Do you see any possible catalyst? What's necessary to bring the kind of changes that are necessary to waken the people up and change this? I mean, we're not overthrow, but reform the system to the point where it can become more rational?
I don't see anything in the horizon that tells me that there's going to be a fundamental shift in my lifetime. I do think that the public's intuition and hatred of Washington is the right track, and I guess the question will be if the Republicans win in 2012 and nothing changes, then people will recognize, wait a minute, nothing changed. And if the Republicans lose in 2012, and they ask themselves why, then perhaps we will see a change in the future. But as I said to you at the beginning of this interview, I'm in a pessimistic mood these days about America. I see a lot of excellent work being done. I see a lot of really good information out there. I see all of the benefits of the internet and interconnectivity. I see all of the possibilities associated with cheaper and cheaper information. But I don't particularly see it being harnessed for good.
Well, certainly the book that you produced with Dana Priest, Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State, is a tool, a valuable tool that could be used to educate people and promote them into action. I'd say most Americans are not aware of anything about what you write, and because the mainstream media doesn't comment about it in the op-ed pages, or maybe once in a while there might be something. Bill Arkin, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today, and Little Brown for publishing your book, which we are offering as a premium here for $150. Continue in your great work. And as again, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us today. And maybe we'll hope for, we have to hope for a better future and hope that our pessimism is misplaced.
I hope our pessimism is misplaced, but the one thing that isn't misplaced, of course, is support for free media.
Support for free media, and that is what we're doing here. And so thanks so much for helping keep that free media alive.